This is the takeaway for Monday, October 16, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. And we begin in Somalia, where two massive truck bombs went off on Saturday in the capital of Mogadishu. The death toll stands at more than 300 now. The president has called for 3 days of mourning. Journalist Mo Dahir was at the scene.
The scene was really devastating. We've never seen such a scene before. A lot of buildings have disappeared, completely became rubble. A lot of dead bodies at the scene, a lot of dead bodies. There was a lot of gunshots, the police panicked. There was a lot of military present. That's the first responders were the military, the police, the traffic policemen, a lot of them.
The attack is being called the deadliest in Somalia's history, but it's one of just many attacks in the Horn of Africa over the last decade since the Islamic insurgency began there. Catherine Hurld is East Africa Bureau Chief at Reuters. Catherine, what's the latest on the attacks?
So the latest on the attacks is that relatives of the missing and the dead are still combing the hospitals to find the remains of their loved ones. We just spoke to a man who had been looking for his sister for 2 days and finally found her hand in a sack of body parts. He was able to identify her by her wedding ring. But there's a lot of people who will probably never be found because one of these truck bombs exploded near a fuel truck. The heat of the explosion was so intense that many people were just simply burned away.
Has anyone come forward to claim responsibility?
Al-Shabaab has not claimed responsibility, although this fits the tactics that they've used before. They've been using increasingly bigger truck bombs in the last couple of years. The targeting is perhaps a bit more unusual, and there's some debate as to whether this particular truck bomb may have detonated prematurely. It was very close to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which might have been the target. Apparently, the driver was also questioned at a checkpoint and sort of rammed his way through and then got stuck in traffic. So Al-Shabaab doesn't usually try to kill very large numbers of civilians indiscriminately, but they have done that before and they haven't claimed responsibility for those attacks either.
Al-Shabaab, you mentioned, this is an Al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamic group in Somalia. What's the broader picture here, Catherine? We always ask, why now?
Well, these operations take months to plan, so it's not necessarily that they decided to do this on Saturday in immediate response to, say, the resignation of the chief of the defense staff and the minister of defense. But the government is somewhat in disarray. The federal government is fighting with the member states. The people, military officers resigned recently because they felt sidelined. So the government, we can say, has been somewhat distracted, and that is never good for coordinating a good response against terrorism.
There's been this grinding Islamic insurgency in Somalia over the last 10 years or longer, Catherine Hurld, as we mentioned. Has there been any significant movement in the government's ability to respond?
Yes, there has. The emergence of regional federal states is very important. Some of them are stronger and better than others. There's now talk of trying to integrate those forces into a national force, but that will still be very difficult. But the government and pro-government forces, and by that I mean peacekeepers, pro-government militias, etc., control much more of Somalia than they used to. When I first started going there about 8 years ago, there was very small pockets of the capital where you could go. Al-Shabaab was forced to withdraw in 2011 and has been steadily losing territory since then. The problem is they maintain the ability to mount these kind of very complex, deadly attacks. And those attacks are getting worse.
And what about the United States, finally? The United States is heavily focused on Syria, on Iraq, on ISIS and Iran, and rightfully so. Is the United States still focused on Al-Qaeda and Somalia?
Somalia has not received top-tier attention for some time. The Americans have been ramping up the pace of things like airstrikes or drone strikes, but it has a limited number of resources that is assigned to it because there are so many hotspots in other parts of the world. So intelligence, machinery, equipment, all this stuff has to be shared. And there's just too many crises going on right now for Somalia to get really the attention that it needs.
Two massive truck bombs in the Somalia capital of Mogadishu, more than 300 people dead. Catherine Harold of Reuters. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Let's check in now on Northern California, where wildfires have destroyed more than 5,000 homes and killed more than 40 people over the last week. The fight is on to contain those fires, and officials now say they're optimistic.
We're turning the corner. We're getting a lot more black line up there. You're seeing those containment levels coming up. Things feel good in our gut as firefighters. So we just need the weather to cooperate with us a little bit, those red flag warnings to stay away. And I feel very confident with all the folks out there that are doing an outstanding job that we will get this thing knocked down for you.
According to officials, nearly 60% of the fire is now contained in Northern California. Now that some of the evacuation orders have been lifted, many residents are finally returning to their neighborhoods to see what's left of their homes. It's the very first step in a long and complicated road to recovery involving insurance and money and decisions that can linger for years. Amy Bach is executive director of United Policyholders. They're a group that helps homeowners with insurance policy issues, especially after disasters. And Amy, when people return home or what used to be home, often with everything gone after a wildfire like this, maybe they have their homeowner's insurance policy in a fire safe. What does starting to think about recovery look like?
It is very much like losing a loved one, losing a home. It's traumatic. People are very disoriented. They are overwhelmed. People can't sleep well. It's pretty fundamental to lose the roof over your head and to lose your lifetime of possessions. It's just overwhelming. That is the word that comes up over and over. And so a lot of what United Policyholders focuses on is assuring people that as strange as they feel is normal, the new normal, we call it, and that there are a lot of people who've been there, done that, and they are here, we are here to impart lessons other people have learned that will help ease their journey on the road to recovery. So, you know, find a place to live is always the first bit of advice. We say, you know, focus on your family's needs first and try to get yourself situated physically so that you will be in a comfortable, safe place in order to make the kind of decisions you're going to have to make in the next months and years ahead.
And then what typically happens when people first start to delve into their insurance policies, into all the issues that they're going to have to think about to get recovered?
Well, you know, cash is king after disaster. So a lot of what we focus on is encouraging people to ask their insurance company for advances, cash advances on the benefits that they will be owed. And insurance companies have a lot of paperwork requirements that they have implemented. And after a very serious or a total loss, those paperwork requirements are pretty tough for people. You know, trying to inventory everything you lost, it's just very daunting. And while we understand insurance companies need to dot I's and cross T's, we went right in to try to ease the flow or open up the flow of cash to the survivors of these horrible wildfires.
And those advances, those cash advances, sound like they could take a lot of the pressure off at the beginning, because there must be a tendency to want to rush, right? It's time for recovery. I have to get my money, and people might want to rush through it.
That's exactly right. And that's really the opposite of what we guide people to do. In other words, you know, a lot of people will feel that they're in shock. It really is shock, and they don't know what they should do, but they feel like they should do something. And a lot of our message, this is actually a Quaker saying, is don't just do something, stand there. So we don't recommend you make any major financial decisions in the first couple of weeks or even month if you can avoid it. And recognize that time is on your side. And statistics are the longer your insurance claim stays open, the more benefits you receive. So a lot of our focus is just encouraging people to try to shelter in place for a little bit and let the information flow at them, but don't try to act on everything that comes at them.
Still, take your time, you know, don't do something, just stand there, is maybe a tough message for somebody who's not living at home, living at a friend's house, or living in an Airbnb somewhere.
It is. It is. It absolutely is. And I think that's why from the get-go, we're pushing out our first steps guidance. We are distributing recovery journals or encouraging people, if you want to help a friend who's had a loss, give them a notebook. It's a pattern, you know. So because a lot of our volunteers and our staff have themselves lost homes, they have a lot of unique empathy and insights for people on what matters and what doesn't matter in this situation.
Well, talk about that a little bit, because I had understood that some of your volunteers had their homes wiped out in fires all across California. I mean, you have people helping you who've been there and not so long ago.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, our very first Roadmap to Recovery event is coming up this coming Wednesday in Santa Rosa. The person who organized it just lost her home, and she connected with our star volunteer, Karen Remus, who lost her home in a San Diego wildfire. And she found Karen, and she found us, and now she's organizing this meeting. Well, that's somebody who just lost her home 4 days ago, but she's got that energy. You know, some people have it, some people can barely speak, but the people who have the energy make a huge difference for their neighbors. And that's kind of a beautiful thing to see, is that kind of paying it forward.
I mean, Amy, there's so much that goes into recovery after a disaster like this, getting your home wiped out, and only part of it is financial. But let's talk about the bottom line just for a second. When all this is over for the people that you work with, somebody whose home was completely turned to ash in a place like Santa Rosa, do they get made whole in the end? Can they get through a disaster like this and look back on it 2, 3, 4 years later and say, it didn't cost me my living?
I would say some people yes, some people no. So it really, there's a spectrum. And the better your insurance coverage is, the better your recovery is going to be. Because it's a myth that the government, you know, rides in and makes everything better. That's not true. The most that folks get from FEMA in a situation like this would be either an SBA loan, which is a good, you know, low interest rate, but still has to be paid back, or an individual assistance grant. And those grants average $5,000, which is not enough to rebuild anyone's house. So the truth is that insurance benefits, you know, are you either have them and then you recover, or you don't and you don't recover. So insurance benefits are a critical lifeline for people. And unfortunately, our experience has been that the benefits don't always flow as they should in a situation where there's a lot of money on the line. And also somewhere between 50% and 60% of the disaster survivors we've encountered over the last 25 years are underinsured. So they don't have enough insurance. They don't have the insurance they thought they had. And so a lot of our focus is on making sure people collect every dime of the benefits that they do have.
Thousands of people taking the first steps on a long road to recovery, rebuilding their lives and rebuilding their homes. Amy Bach and her volunteers are there to help them in Northern California. Amy Bach is Executive Director of United Policyholders. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's talk about healthcare now. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. You know, there are strange policies and pitfalls all over America's tangled healthcare system. But maybe none of them are as weird and as maddening as the story of the $629 Band-Aid.
So we got the bill here for $629. Now let's just recap. She saw a doctor for about 5 minutes. The doctor told us everything was fine and cleaned the wound with a wet paper towel and put a Band-Aid on it.
That's Malcolm Bird, who took his daughter to an emergency room after she cut her finger and then left, as you heard there, with a $629 bill. Bird told his story to Sarah Cliff, a healthcare reporter and senior policy correspondent at Vox. So Sarah started looking at the $629 Band-Aid and what it says about American healthcare. She tells the story in the first episode of Vox's new podcast called The Impact.
This is a Vox reader who reached out to me with this bill that, even though, you know, as a healthcare reporter, I see a lot of bills, this one struck me as pretty incredible. As he explained, he had a very short trip to the emergency room after his wife was clipping their one-year-old daughter's fingernails and clipped a little too far on one of them. And as he describes it, blood just started getting everywhere. They were worried new parents. They went to the emergency room because it was the weekend, it was the only thing open, and it seemed fine. The doctor bandaged it up. A few weeks later, yeah, they get this $629 bill, and he's just a little bit baffled at how this short incident that resulted in a Band-Aid being put on his daughter's finger could end up costing so much. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized there's a really interesting healthcare story here about how these prices are just completely unregulated, how that makes us really different from other countries. And that's how you end up with these really crazy sounding healthcare bills.
So how do we get here to $629, which is insane?
Yeah, so I got a copy of the bill, and it turns out they were billing $7 for the Band-Aid itself, which is still a lot for one single Band-Aid, a lot more than you pay at any drugstore. The other $622 were something I hadn't heard of before. It's called an emergency room facility fee. It is basically the price of walking into an emergency room and seeking service, no matter what it is you're getting. So you could be coming in with a finger that's bleeding, with a gunshot, and they're going to charge you this fee. I didn't realize, you know, those existed before, but it turns out they do. I've been reviewing more and more bills from hospitals all across the country. They vary hugely. You know, I've seen ones as low as $300, as high as $3,000. And they're secret. You know, you're not going to see these posted on the emergency room door. You're just going to find out, like Malcolm did, when you're expected to pay it, regardless of what the actual price is.
Well, Sarah, you set out on this quest to try to find out where these facility fee prices actually come from. Here's Zach Cooper. He's a professor at Yale, talking to you about why these prices don't make any sense.
Charges are just sort of made up. A lot of hospitals, like in the 70s, they basically like made a list of things and came up with some number that made sense then. And it was in a book, and then some guy adjusts it for inflation.
And literally, Sarah, it sounds like he's saying somebody made it up.
So when you talk to hospital executives, and in Malcolm's case, the hospital executive actually wrote him a letter when he complained about the bill. He argued that this is the cost of keeping an emergency room up and running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, able to see a little girl who has a finger injury or that gunshot wound or someone who has a stroke. A lot of health economists are pretty skeptical of that argument. Because you see such widespread variation, you think, you know, emergency rooms, there is a little bit of variety, but the price of running one should be roughly in some kind of ballpark. And like I said, these fees are just all over the place, and they're kept secret. You know, they are not put out there publicly to say, okay, we charge $622 because we have all these machines that we bought, and here's how we get to that number. You know, I reached out to the hospital asking them to explain, well, how do you get to this number to run your emergency room? And they just wouldn't return my calls.
But why do the insurance companies put up with this degree of opacity? I mean, you would think that the people who are paying a lot of the time, at least after your deductible is met, would say, we want price transparency. We're not paying $600 for a Band-Aid.
You know, I think they do their best to make that case. But at the end of the day, hospitals have more muscle in these kind of negotiations. And insurance companies can try their best to negotiate down prices. But at the end of the day, the hospital is the one who owns that emergency room.
Well, when it comes to patients, Sarah Cliff, why is this market so distorted in America? I mean, with any other product, somebody who could do the service for cheaper would say, come to Cliff Care Emergency Room. We only charge you $50 for a Band-Aid, not like the other guys, and we take care of pinkies just as well. Does that kind of thing exist?
Yeah, you know, it's really a policy story about how we've built our health insurance world. You know, I think one thing that is going on is most other countries, you know, basically every other developed country, they have price regulation in healthcare. They've decided healthcare is something like a utility, like electricity or water, and therefore the government should regulate it as such, that it's something everyone needs to stay alive. We made the decision not to go that route in the United States. So hospitals can essentially choose whatever prices it is they would like to set. And like I said, you know, you're often dealing with areas where you have one dominant hospital system that can really pick its own price. And you're right, it doesn't operate like other markets. You know, there aren't prices posted. One of the reasons that hasn't happened is most of us are insulated from a lot of our healthcare costs. The vast majority of Americans have some form of insurance. We are going to have our bills paid by our health insurance plan. But you've seen a huge rise in high deductible plans. Malcolm, for example, that entire $629 bill, that was in his deductible. So he was 100% responsible. So I think you might see a shift towards the situation you talk about as deductibles continue to rise. And all of a sudden, patients are the ones on the hook for these really significant bills.
There have been a lot of moves from the government over the last few years. At least there were a couple of years ago. More transparency at hospitals, even HHS at one point was saying, we're going to publish more data on quality of care at hospitals. We want consumers to have more information. Nobody has penetrated the world of hospital pricing in this way?
Not quite yet. We're actually launching a project here at Vox to crowdsource facility fees because I've been looking for this data set. I've wanted to know what are the facility fees all across the country. And that data is typically kept private. Insurance companies don't want their competitors to know what rate they negotiated, and hospitals see, you know, no reason to make this public. So we're actually trying to take this into our own hands at Vox, and we are launching this project today to get people to send us their emergency bills, because we believe that's the best way to actually get this information.
The story of the $629 Band-Aid, a purely American story, is the first installment of the new podcast at Vox called The Impact, and Sarah Cliff is the host. Sarah, great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel. Babbel.com. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me.
The United States and South Korea have begun 10 days of naval exercises in the seas off the Korean Peninsula. It's 10 days of war games, including an aircraft carrier from the Navy's 7th Fleet. Now, drills like this aren't new, but this one comes at a time of major tension as North Korea tests ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear weapons. North Korea sees the exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. State media there called the drills reckless and said the government would renew its threats against the U.S. territory of Guam. Dr. Balbina Wong is a visiting professor at Georgetown University and a former senior advisor at the State Department for Asian Affairs. Dr. Wong, what's the message the U.S. is sending here?
Well, there's two things. The first is the actual message itself and the signaling versus the very careful way in which we need to read the actual vocabulary that is being used. So, for example, while North Korea calls these war games, for the United States and South Korea, which have a security alliance and quite a robust one, these are essentially regular drills that are practiced in order for defense of South Korea and for the deterrence of future North Korean actions.
So the United States and North Korea say that this is purely for defense of the South, but what's the message that Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans are likely to hear?
Well, I think this is exactly the point. We have to remember the Korean War never technically ended. And so any country that is still in a state of war with a neighbor will have very strong defenses and needs to practice those defenses. Now, given the rise in rhetoric between the two leaders of North Korea and the United States, these are meant as signals to North Korea, precisely because North Korea has conducted numerous acts of essentially aggression in the last several years. And so the heightening of the signaling is meant to send a signal to Kim Jong-un that if he continues to more tests, then the United States is prepared to come to the defense of its allies.
Is there something qualitatively different about these exercises that make them stand out from the ones that have been going on, as you say, for 50 or 60 years? Is the U.S. ratcheting up the message?
Yes and no. Strategically, I do not think there is a difference. And in fact, I would argue that the tension today is not the highest we've ever seen on the Korean Peninsula since the 1953 armistice. Despite what the public may feel and the way the media has covered these incidents, there have actually been numerous other times throughout the decades at which we have been much closer, I would argue, to an all-out war. The point here, though, is that Kim Jong-un is speeding up his aggressive pursuit of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, which are the missiles. And this is a clear violation of all international laws and all international norms. So if Kim Jong-un continues on this path, it is up to the United States as the global leader, and of course, as the main supporter of South Korea, to try to deter North Korea from these further acts of aggression.
Dr. Wong, you're not the first expert or analyst on this show to say that despite the news and despite the rhetoric, not much has really changed in the big picture between the North, the South, and the United States here. So if that's the case, what's your view of a way out here from this dynamic?
Well, it depends on what you actually mean by the way out. I think most of the world right now is focused on the nuclear weapons issue and, of course, the missile issue. However, those are, to me, actually the symptoms of the fundamentally larger problem, which is that we have a divided Korean peninsula since the end of World War II. So fundamentally, we have to address this problem of a divided Korea and a Korea that is at war with itself. So if we want to try to address just the nuclear issues, we can probably eventually manage to do that through a series of talks. But that will eventually not solve the problem. So we have to get at a permanent peace treaty between the two Koreas.
Dr. Balbina Wong at Georgetown, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, offering a family-centered, integrated approach to treatment for men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders. More at westbridge.org.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Austria looks like it's about to get a new chancellor, the youngest to head a current government anywhere in the world. The Austrian People's Party surged to victory in the country's elections on Monday with about 30% of the vote. That's enough to form a coalition and control the parliament. Their leader is Sebastian Kurz. He's just 31 years old, and he ran on an anti-immigration platform previously reserved for Austria's far-right parties. Matthew Karnichnik is chief Europe correspondent for Politico. He's in Vienna. Matthew, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a new name for a lot of people, especially in the United States. Who is Sebastian Kurz, and what's led to his swift rise in Austria?
Well, he's a 31-year-old foreign minister of Austria at the moment. And what's really led to his rise is the refugee crisis in Europe, with Austria really having been on the forefront of that crisis back in 2015, as I'm sure some people will remember, when a lot of Syrians and others started coming up through the Balkans, through Austria, and into Germany. And though there was a lot of focus at the time about Germany and what was happening there, in fact, more refugees per capita ended up in Austria at the time. And he really made this the focus of the campaign, because back last year, he really pushed for the closure of what they call the Balkan route, which was the main migration route where Syrians were coming up through Turkey. And he's sort of taken credit for helping stop the flow of refugees back then. Although many people dispute his role there, Austrians really credit him with this. And that kind of led to his success in the election yesterday.
I read one report that said 150,000 asylum seekers have come to Austria since 2015 in a country of only 9 million people. So it has been a big issue there. What has been Sebastian Kurz's message?
His essential message has been that Europe needs to do more to protect its borders. They need to do more in Austria to stop what some people call the Islamization of Austrian society. So there's been a real co-opting, if you will, of what have traditionally been far-right positions in Austria. And Kurz, who's a very young man, obviously, very telegenic, he's often described as the son-in-law of the nation, has given this type of rhetoric a somewhat softer face. And so he has pursued a lot of the same rhetoric without having the same kind of edge that most people usually associate with far-right populism.
So what does this election in Austria say about where Europe might be headed, or does it say anything?
I think it says a couple of things. First of all, the far right here did not do as well as they themselves had hoped and as many people had thought. It looks now like they finished in third place, and there was an expectation 6 months ago that they would finish first. So what's happened is that Sebastian Kurz, who comes from the centrist party here, has moved his party to the right, has again more or less stolen many of the positions of the far right. And I think for the European view, what that means is that this is an example of how mainstream politicians can succeed by adopting the policies of the far right. And this has been a controversial discussion in many countries, because a lot of political advisors say that's the last thing that you should be doing, because what's going to happen is that your voters are going to go to the original. They're going to go to the populists. And what Sebastian Kurz has shown in Austria is that you can win as a mainstream politician adopting some of these far right positions if you have the right person at the top of the party. So I do think that this will resonate beyond
Austria's borders.
Matthew Karnichnig, chief Europe correspondent for Politico in Austria. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Emory Jones was 16 years old, locked up in a Broward County, Florida juvenile detention facility when a guard began regularly beating him for cursing.
It's right there, the mark right there. You know, he gonna make sure you don't go to the hospital. It don't show, like, later on, he was like, "Ooh, boy, I got you good. Let me see that there."
He's gonna make sure it doesn't show. Emory's story is just one part of an expansive and disturbing Miami Herald investigation into Florida's Department of Juvenile Justice. And after one of as many as 12 teens died under questionable circumstances in detention, senior investigative reporter Carol Marbin Miller and the Miami Herald decided to launch an investigation into the state's juvenile justice system. They published the stories last week, and Carol says what they found was disturbing.
We found primarily a high degree of unnecessary and excessive force by officers and youth care workers, and we found that officers had come up with an idea for avoiding that kind of force directly by outsourcing it to some of the kids in this odd thing we discovered called honey bunning, in which officers and youth workers will designate goons within the facilities who will beat up other kids and be rewarded with a honey bun or a Snickers bar or a McDonald's hamburger. We found a high degree of sexual misconduct on the part of officers and youth workers and a propensity for covering that up. And we found that most of those things were the result of very poor hiring practices in which both the state-run lockups and the privately run commitment centers pay a woeful salary and hire folks who are poorly vetted. We found that some of the youth workers have criminal histories that are not much better than the kids. And the Department of Juvenile Justice was doing a terrible job of vetting those people. Hundreds of youth care workers throughout Florida are washed up prison guards, men and women who had been fired by the Department of Corrections for wrongdoing. And somehow the Department of Juvenile Justice looked at their resumes, confirmed that they had worked for another state agency, but didn't try to figure out what they'd done there and why they left.
You're reporting on a wide range of abusive behaviors here, both on the part of juvenile justice workers and workers fomenting abuse among kids themselves. Is this confined to one facility or two, or is this widespread throughout the state?
It is widespread throughout the state of Florida. The incident that sparked our curiosity was what we believe to have been a honey bunning of a youth at the lockup in Miami, a 17-year-old who was beaten to death by a dozen or more other detained youth. And we wanted to test the theory that this was a systemic problem. So we obtained hundreds and hundreds of investigative reports from State Department of Juvenile Justice. And what we found was that the incidents that concerned us here in Miami were going on all over the state with regard to the mercenary system, the goons. We found incidents of that in Jacksonville, in Tampa, in Okeechobee, in Fort Myers, in Dade, in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale. It's very much a systemic problem.
Your investigation also includes video evidence, surveillance cameras in some of the juvenile justice facilities. There's one video clip of an officer calling for something called youth support. That's what they call it in the hallway. A signal for juvenile detainees to get together, drag another kid into a room, and beat him, all under the supervision of an officer.
That was more common than we expected to find, and it was surprising and disturbing how many incidents of this type of behavior we came across. And not just in the written reports, but in the videos that go with the written reports. There's one video you can see on our website in which two young men are pummeling each other. They are shirtless. They are wearing what appear to be boxing shorts. And there are two officers who are standing by, essentially refereeing. And that is one of many videos that we've got available on our site that depict episodes of officer-sponsored boxing matches. And it's why we called the series Fight Club. We were really surprised at how common it was for officers to set up fights. There were allegations that they were betting on the outcome, basically turning troubled kids into gladiators.
What is the State Department of Juvenile Justice saying about your report? What is the governor saying? What's the state saying?
Well, the governor has said nothing. The Department of Juvenile Justice issued a statement a couple few hours after we published. They don't quibble with any of our findings. In fact, they have not taken issue with any of the facts contained in the series. They are upset that they don't feel we gave them adequate credit for some of the reforms that they have made. One of their contentions is that we have not given them proper credit for the dramatic decline in youth crime in Florida. The problem with that reasoning is that youth crime has plummeted throughout the country. Every state in America has experienced a dramatic decline in youthful offense, about 50%, in fact, over the last decade. Our answer to that is that while it is true that there are some very good policies and procedures on the books, and there are some talented, hardworking, and decent people working for this agency, it is hard to look at those videos and hard to read those reports and not conclude that there is something terrible going on within these facilities.
Are other states doing juvenile justice differently? Is there a model of a better way that's available to the governor and to Florida if they look for it?
There is, and it comes from a surprising place. The state of Missouri, which is a very law and order conservative state, implemented what is widely regarded as the most effective, the most progressive, and really the most successful juvenile justice reform model called the Missouri model. And what they did was they closed down the big juvenile institutions, the places that resemble adult prisons. And they house the majority of their juvenile delinquents in group homes, in much smaller home-like settings, where in Florida, youth in commitment facilities mostly sleep in cells with metal slabs. In Missouri, they sleep in bedrooms with bunk beds, and they have quilts, and they can have stuffed animals if they want to. We toured New York City as part of our research. And New York City has implemented a reform program that they called Close to Home because their philosophy underscores returning kids to neighborhoods and communities under the theory that that's where they do best. And while it is too soon to tell whether New York will be as effective as Missouri, there's no question in my mind that the conditions are more humane. What we saw, we toured a particular group home in Queens, and it looked like a home, like a college frat house where kids were living in bedrooms, again, with carpeting and quilts and all the amenities of home. Just very little resemblance to the razor wire ringed fortresses that we have in Florida.
Carol Marvin Miller, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Carol Marvin Miller is senior investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. You can find a link to the Miami Herald's reporting on our website at thetakeaway.org, and you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. 5 years ago, this nice little song became an international sensation. Show that ass. Not so nice, not so little anymore, right? Well, Russian punk music doesn't usually hit the mainstream, but in 2012, it captured the world's attention. In February of that year, the Russian protest band Pussy Riot climbed up to the altar of the Cathedral of Christ Savior Church in Moscow wearing neon balaclavas and sang their song, Mother Mary, Banish Putin. The next month, three members of the band were arrested and charged with hooliganism motivated by religious hatred and eventually sent to prison. One of those women is Masha Alyokina. She got out of prison in December of 2013. She's still in the band, still a political activist, and she's here in the United States now to act in a play called Burning Doors in several cities across the country. And she has a new book out. It's called Riot Days, all about her band's protest at the church in Moscow and her time in a prison colony.
I think this is not about role of the church. It's about our right to criticize it, our right to make jokes about it. There is no ideal system. That's why political art exists. It's about asking questions, maybe uncomfortable questions, but only them are pushing any society forward.
Well, your satire landed you in prison, as I mentioned, a prison colony. You write a lot about your experience in the prison colony in this book. Not a maximum security prison like we might see here in America, more of a camp. Can you describe the environment and what it was like for you there?
In Russia, we don't have low, middle, or high security prisons. We have Soviet Union system. It looks like, let's say, strange village. Mm. And people there are living not in the cells, but on the barracks. There is a one bedroom for 100 people, and they are living sleeping together, like on the iron beds. And there are about like three toilets, no hot water, and it's necessary to work there. The cynical thing is that the work which administration provides to prisoners, it's a sewing of police uniform and a uniform for Russian army. The salary is almost not exist. It's like $2-3 per month. So it's almost legal slavery. And when I came there, I was quite surprised. And after some time, I just understood that even there, we can try to change it.
While you were in the prison colony, you began a hunger strike. You wrote in the book that once you enter a hunger strike, it becomes not about the goal that you thought it was about in the first place, that really it's about having a space, a right to be able to protest in the very first place.
On that time, when I started the hunger strike, a lot of things were done by us, by me and my lawyer and all the team of activists who came to the another part of the country to support me. For example, we won a court against prison guards. And after this court, huge changes start to come. For example, they start to reconstruct barracks. They start to put up salaries a little bit, and 8 prison guards were fired.
Masha, I'm interested in what made you this way. What made you want to go up against a government as powerful as yours, knowing that you could potentially go to prison?
I don't like when something is unfair, because it's unfair. And also, I hate when somebody starts to create rules and cannot explain them. I think it's all started in the school. In Russian schools, we have so-called labor lessons, when teachers separate girls from boys, and they start to teach boys how to, I don't know, make furniture, for example, and the girls, they teach how to sew oven gloves. And when I was like 11 years old, I asked, why I need these oven gloves? I mean, there are like hundreds of supermarkets, and I mean, I'm not going to spend my time in the kitchen. And they just said, because we are saying. And when somebody is saying something like that, I'm not agree. I just will not do it.
later when you were a teenager, where did you have the same feeling?
It's not only feeling. It's all my way of existing. Because, I mean, the face of the system, unfortunately, we can see in the all institutions in Russia, for example. I didn't grow up in other country, but I'm sure that it's not only about Russia. It's just sometimes they provide any rules just to approve their power, and it's not right.
You know, punks hate indoctrination. Punks hate conformity. And Pussy Riot's, they're punks. But not every punk after the show where they say, you know, screw you to the leaders or to indoctrination, not everybody chooses to take it to the next step. Not everybody chooses to really challenge authority in a way that frankly endangers their own lives. But you did. There are lots of punks in the world, but most of them don't go this far.
It's not about far. It's about responsibility. If you're saying something, stand up for that. Otherwise, do not say it. I think it's quite simple.
Do you think that a leader like Vladimir Putin, former KGB, with total control over the country, that this type of control requires this type of protest? Because you said to back down even an inch is to give a whole mile, right? That's what I mean by going this far, to say not even an inch. Is that what's necessary with Vladimir Putin?
I think it's necessary not only with Vladimir Putin. It's just important anywhere. And I mean, I wrote this book not to show kind of Putin's Russia. I wrote it because I believe that every person has a choice and a right to speak. And yes, in my life, there were these conditions and these circumstances. But I want just to show that this is possible. It's for making more protest art in the world. Maybe somebody will just suddenly find it somewhere, find this book somewhere and read it and understand that that I can.
Speak out.
Speak out. It's not about a protest in the square or in the church or anywhere. It can be a classroom. It can be your workplace, anywhere.
Masha Alyokhina is a member of Pussy Riot. She is here in America performing in the new play Burning Doors with Belarus Free Theater, and also author of Riot Days, the new book all about the history of Pussy Riot, their arrest, their imprisonment, and the aftermath of their protest. Masha, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, Masha is out of prison after her protest. How important is protest to you?
This is Steve from the Lower East Side. Those of us who are fortunate enough to have any spare time should be protesting on a regular basis. It's shocking to me that people spend hundreds of hours a year in the gym trying to strengthen their bodies while putting zero effort into addressing the ills that plague our society. Plus, marching in the streets is good exercise.
Well, do you get in the streets to exercise or just to exercise your rights? Either way, we want to hear from you. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Send us a tweet, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.